MacCast, Tuesday, October 1st, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I hope you're having a little bit better week than I am. I'm in recovery mode. You may have heard me on some other shows, or maybe even possibly on the MacCast member show that I just put out, but I've been under the weather a little bit. There's this nasty cold that's been going around, and I picked it up, and it's been a little bit tricky. But you don't really want to hear all about that. You tune in to hear about the latest app in Apple and Mac news, and we've got a ton of that as well. A lot of details coming out now that iOS 7's been out in the wild. People have their iPhone 5Ss and 5Cs. Those are getting inspected, put under microscopes, analyzed, and we're getting a lot more details about what's making those click, how much money Apple's making off of those. We got an iMac update that came out. Of course, new rumors and things to discuss. What's going to happen with the next generation iPads, including that Retina iPad mini, and some connector stuff going on in the EU. We're going to talk about that. And of course, we have all your great feedback on your iPhone 5S experiences. I actually have a little bit of follow-up from George Starcher on some of the things that we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast. And then I have some security updates and a whole bunch of other stuff, including a little twist of fate. There's an iOS blue screen of death, I guess. Believe it or not, I'm going to tell you how that can happen. So it should be a pretty fun show. But before we dive into that, let me take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, Connected Data, makers of the Transporter. I've been telling you about the Transporter for a little bit. I actually have one, and it is a networked peer-to-peer storage device that lets you privately share, access, and back up your files. And I keep mentioning that it is peer-to-peer and it's private, and I wanted to explain that a little bit more, actually how this thing works, how you set it up. So when you get your Transporter, it's this little appliance. It has a power cable or power and has a network connection, an Ethernet connection. So you take it out of the box. You can order it pre-configured with a 1 terabyte or a 3 terabyte drive. You can also get a Transporter unit without a drive, put in your own 2.5-inch hard drive, and then you plug it into power, you plug it into your network. If you want to go wireless, you can get a USB wireless adapter option, hook it up that way. And then once it's connected on your network, you go to your Mac, your PC, you download the Transporter software, you run the little program, and it will go out, it'll recognize your Transporter on your network. You claim it, and then it sends you to a web interface to configure it. Now, on the web interface, all you're doing is setting up how you want to create folders and share information on your Transporter, the actual hardware device. It's just configuring it, but you're not actually moving files or storage into the cloud. Everything stays stored on your Transporter. It can be accessed remotely because the web service acts as a little bit of a traffic cop, allowing you to get back and connect to your home network, to the Transporter connected to your home network, but you're always connecting directly. So nothing ever goes out onto someone else's server. It's all stays within your control on your Transporter, and you choose how you want to set that up, how you want to let people connect it. And then on your home network, it sets up a little folder, a Transporter folder in your home folder, and then you can see all of the files and folders and things that you're sharing with different people, with other Transporters, and you can share in multiple ways. Not everybody has to have a Transporter to share. You can actually share from Transporter to a Mac or a PC and vice versa. You can also go from Transporter to Transporter, which is actually a great way to have a remote backup of your files. So if you get two Transporters, you can put one in a remote location, say at an office or at a vacation house or at a friend or relative's house, and then you can set it up so that the folders sync from one Transporter to another. So anything you put on one Transporter is automatically backed up and synced to another one. But again, directly, nothing going through the cloud. So all your files and your data stays in your control within your network, within your devices. It's transferred over the internet securely by a secure connection so you can keep everything safe and protected. And you also then get remote access to your transporter, even if your Mac or PC isn't turned on, because it's just hooked up to your network like a network-attached storage device. You can run the transporter app on your iPhone, your iPad, your Android device, and you can get remote access to all your files and data that is stored on your transporter. And with the new 2.0 software, it's gotten even easier to set up and configure. It's got a bunch of great new features. You can create shared links. So if you put a file on your transporter, you can create a link to that, send that out to people so that they can download it directly from your transporter. And it's just this really cool device that you should check out. You can go to filetransporter.com/Maccast to get all the details, see what the thing looks like if you haven't seen one. And since you're a Maccast listener, you can get 10% off when you purchase your transporter from the transporter store. So just go to filetransporterstore.com, and when you're checking out, use the code Maccast after you select your transporter. Pricing starts at just $199. So go take a look, and a big thank you to Connected Data for their support of the Maccast. The iPhone 5S and 5C have been out for a little while now, and of course, the reviewers have gotten their hands on them, and most of the reviews have been extremely positive. People seem to be loving the iPhone 5S and 5C. I've told you a little bit about how much I'm enjoying my new 5S, and we'll talk about that a little bit more on this show. But also, the devices have gotten in the hands of the dissectors. Chipworks and iFixit have pulled these things into their labs and done their voodoo magic stuff. They've put it under microscopes and x-ray machines and all that sort of thing that they do. And we now know a little bit more about that custom silicone that Apple's putting in that shiny new eye thing. As it turns out, the chip, despite many of us thinking that Apple would be moving away from Samsung, the A7 chip turns out to be manufactured by Samsung still. It's using their latest 28 nanometer process node. The transistors are also apparently packed more densely than before, down 7.3% to 114 nanometers. That varies from what was in the A6, which I guess had transistors spaced at 123 nanometers. So that tighter packing on a larger size die, because the chip itself is actually a little bit larger than the A6, I guess means that Apple has been able to cram about 1 billion transistors onto that chip. It's still a dual core processor. We kind of knew that before. Also, it has 1 gigabyte of RAM, nearest as anybody can tell. So that stat remains the same, but it is now 64 bit. So it's actually performing very, very well. Actually, still the fastest processor out on the market, even up against some of the quad-core and 8-core chips that have been showing up in some of the Android devices that are hitting the market these days. The company's also turned their microscopes on the M7 Motion coprocessor, and we have a little more details on that. Turns out it looks like it's an ARM Cortex M3 part from NXP, and it's running at about 180 megahertz. The speculation is that the M7 is actually probably a custom chip, because it didn't look like something that was off the shelf from NXP, although they do have components that they sell direct. But this one looks to be some custom design that was properly actually made exclusively to Apple's specifications. It contains a 3-axis accelerometer, a 3-axis gyroscope, and a 3-axis electronic compass integrated circuit, and collects data at low power. That we kind of knew. It grabs that data from the accelerometer, from the gyroscope, from the magnetometer. But what's really cool is it takes that data and does super duper math processing to it, uses all of its skills to get the absolute orientation of your device relative to the Earth. That's really, really cool. And it's going to enable all kinds of cool things in software. We've been hearing about some of them, but, you know, like indoor mapping applications. Of course, you have all of the sports and fitness applications that are being put out right now. A lot of apps are being updated to take advantage of this data. And the really cool thing about the data is it runs at super low power. So you're going to be able to collect all that data and information. I read one article that said it stores about 7 days worth of this data, and it can actually suck that in In the past, so when you install a new app that wants access to this data, it can actually go back and get up to 7 days worth of information and pre-populate your steps and your, you know, how far you've gone and where you've climbed to and all that sort of stuff. Because again, it's tracking all of this stuff against the globe. Just, it's mind-boggling how cool this little tiny chip is, and it's super small. As a matter of fact, I think iFixit had a hard time even finding the chip at first, but it is definitely in there, and it's a little bit of cool tech. So we're discovering and finding out some cool details behind all this technology that Apple's packed into these new phones. There's several other interesting stories related to iOS 7, the iPhone 5S, and the 5C coming out. A lot of them highlighting the successes of Apple's new devices now that the technology is out in the wild. As a matter of fact, it looks like the iPhone 5C is a lot more, or significantly more, profitable than its predecessor, the iPhone 5. And it turns out the 5S is just a little bit more costly for Apple to manufacture. A couple different organizations have done their breakdown of what's called the bill of materials, basically all the various components and technology that go into making one of these devices. They price out all the wholesale prices of the bits and pieces and get a picture of what the parts cost for Apple to actually, you know, what they have to pay to actually get all the bits and pieces to put one of these things together. And it's actually pretty typical when you have these alternate year S releases that the pricing, the cost of materials doesn't go up all that much. And it turns out that's the case for the iPhone 5S, even though it has some pretty major new bits of technology in there. We've got the A7 running at 64-bit. You've got that new Touch ID sensor. You've got the new M7 Motion Coprocessor. So I thought it would have been a little bit higher, but it's just slightly higher. Starting with the iPhone 5C, IHS, iSupply did their breakdown, and they found that the 5C actually costs Apple about 12% less to build than the iPhone 5. They came in with a build price of about $175 per unit. Apple sells them at a retail price, unsubsidized, $549 US. So that is an implied gross margin of about 72% if you're using IHS's numbers. Now, that doesn't factor in things like the actual manufacturing costs, the assembly costs, the shipping costs, advertising, and some of the other just costs of actually getting the thing into market and selling it. We're talking about just the bill of materials versus what Apple sells it for at full retail. So we got to take that 72% gross margin with a little bit of a grain of salt. But UBS also did their breakdown and build of materials analysis, and they found even better numbers for the iPhone 5C. According to their numbers, a 16-gigabyte model came in at a parts cost of about $156, and then the iPhone 5S, they estimated a 16-gigabyte model came in at about $213 for Apple to pay all the parts. That's just $8 more than what it was costing Apple, apparently, to make the iPhone 5. So not a lot more, and they're still getting the same retail pricing for those units at the various sizes. So that means that UBS estimates that Apple is keeping their margins somewhere in the 50% range, which is where Apple really likes to have them. We've seen them go as low, I think on the iPad mini, we were hearing numbers around the 30-40% range, but 50% would not be too shabby. So with Apple selling, what, 9 million units in the first week, and most of the numbers I've been seeing have been saying that's about 50% iPhone 5C, 50% iPhone 5S, maybe 40-60, depending upon whose numbers you're looking at. I think it just translates into Apple's quarterly numbers when they do that next quarterly results call. That says to me they're going to have huge profits and they're going to add significantly to their cash hoard. So that was kind of cool to see reported and see some of those numbers coming out this week. Also, iOS 7 is being picked up and adopted and loved by tons and tons of people. That's despite getting some mixed reviews in the press. Some people have been kind of critical of the new design and some of the new features, but overall, it's sounding like users, you and I, and Apple's customers are flocking to iOS 7 faster than they ever have before. The upgrade rates are higher than ever. We've heard various reports from different sources, all citing adoption rates of about 50 to 60% just a week or so after Apple released the new S, which is just phenomenal. That means 50 to 60% of us have already updated to iOS 7, those of us who can. And as far as customer satisfaction, it's going to take some time to find out how people are responding to it, but at least one firm, Pfeiffer Consulting, did a user interface survey, or a user experience survey, rather, of iOS 7, iOS 6, Android running on Samsung devices, Windows 8, and BlackBerry 10, and they found that the user experience satisfaction, what they call the for what they call average non-technical users. I don't know how they're deciding who's an average non-technical user, but supposedly that's who they included in their study. They said among that group, when they showed them all these different operating systems, asked them about it, 73% were most satisfied with iOS 7, 70% with iOS 6, and then Android had a satisfaction rate of 57%, BlackBerry 56%, and Windows Phone came in last at 47%. So consumers seem to be loving iOS 7, and just in terms of usability, at least according to that one study. Again, I'm going to take that with a grain of salt, but overall, I have to say my personal experience with iOS 7, I love it. It's a little bit of a jarring change at first. Luckily, I've been using it since the early beta builds. I was in the iOS developer program, so I started using it back in June, and I think it took me a couple weeks to transition to become really comfortable with it. And now, having used it on a daily basis for a couple months, it's just completely natural, and I actually love the look of it. The colors, I'm still, you know, debating on. It's a little pastel-y for me, I think, personally. But as more and more developers have been updating their apps, I'm actually really liking the user experience. About the only thing that still really throws me off is the fact that the buttons don't have any kind of button borders. So sometimes that bothers me a little bit. I'm not really sure what to click. It feels like you're clicking a hyperlink in a browser. And, you know, just personally, that's not my favorite experience. But that's a minor annoyance more than anything else. Overall, I love the new look. It seems much more open, much cleaner to me than all that prior shadowing and 3D effects and the skeuomorphic stuff. I think a lot of that stuff got in the way of the experience a little bit. So I really like it. And it looks like Apple may be winning over, at least temporarily, some of Samsung's customers. Gazelle, you know, they sponsor the show. It's where I resold my iPhones. They said that they saw a 210% increase in the number of Samsung phones being traded in during the iPhone 5S, 5C launch weekend. Now, I wouldn't read too much into this yet, other than to say, isn't that interesting? I think overall, people like shiny new things, and the iPhone 5S especially is a really cool shiny new thing. I think a lot of people want to try it out. I know there's some people out there that have been frustrated with the Android experience and maybe want to try to give the iPhone a try, and now would be a good time to move on that. I think a lot of people have been waiting for new devices to come out. Gazelle did note that overall trade-ins over the launch weekend were up 4 times over last year's iPhone 5 launch. So it does seem like more people are hopping on the iPhone 5S, iPhone 5C bandwagon, and it would naturally make sense that a lot of them want to just trade in their older devices. So if you were on Android, you're trading in your old Android device. If you were on iPhone, you were probably trading in some of your old iPhone devices. So I don't know if it necessarily means that people are flocking away from Android in droves, and my suspicion is that we'll find out that people are still preferring Android over iOS just in terms of sheer volume, but definitely a lot of people want to check out the new iPhones, and some are for sure trading those Android devices to fund their transition to the iPhone. And then if you need to get your hands on an iPhone, we know on launch weekend it was pretty tricky to do. If you pre-ordered, you had to wait a little bit, probably not as long as you might have expected. And I know that now order times, ship times are, I think, a couple weeks out at this point if you order online. But if you want to try and pick up an iPhone, specifically an iPhone 5S in store, I think if you go to an Apple retail store, 5Cs, I've been hearing, are pretty well stocked, so you can get your hands on those pretty easily. But if you've been looking to get an iPhone iPhone 5S. I had mentioned that Apple was letting you go buy online and then pick up in store. They had pulled that back the last time we talked on the MacCast. Well, now it has been re-enabled. So you can go online, you can order an iPhone 5S, and if it's available in your local retail store, you can head over there and pick it up. As far as finding availability or when the best time to actually order is, I've heard for years that Apple updates their system, their stocking system, sometime in the evening. Typically, people tell me it happens around 10 p.m. Pacific time. I don't have verification on that. That's a total just speculation and rumor, but I thought I'd throw it out there because a couple people emailed me to mention that they've had the best luck around 10 p.m. Pacific time, jumping on the Apple online store and putting their order in then. And then, you know, you can click over on the right-hand side, check availability to check your regional local stores. I think you put in your zip code, and then it'll tell you which stores have stock, and you can see if it's something there that you can just run out the next day and pick up. But play around with it. Go on Apple's website, and you might have luck if you've been chomping at the bit to get a new iPhone 5S and just want to know in advance if they're going to have it at that local retail store. You don't want to go down there and be disappointed when they tell you they're all out of stock, especially those rare gold models. Apple did reportedly, and I think we mentioned this last time, bump up production about 33% on the gold model. So hopefully that supply problem is going to be being taken care of. But that's some of the latest with what's happening with iPhone 5S, 5C, and iOS 7. Other big news this week was that the iMacs finally got their Haswell bump. Early last week, Apple quietly updated the 21.5-inch and 27-inch models with those new Intel processors. The update also brought on the 802.11ac Wi-Fi as well as new graphics options. There's new NVIDIA GeForce 700 series graphics, along, of course, with the better integrated Haswell graphics, the Intel integrated graphics. The design overall remains the same, but Apple did ramp up the flash storage. They bumped it up to faster PCIe storage, so your flash memory is going to run a little bit faster on those new models. The new entry-level 21.5-inch iMac features a 2.7 gigahertz quad-core Intel Core i5 processor and those updated Iris Pro integrated graphics. On the high end, the 21.5-inch model and both 27-inch models feature a quad-core Intel Core i5 processor running at up to 3.4 gigahertz and using the NVIDIA GeForce 700 series graphics that has twice the video memory of the prior generation model. And if you want to bump up all the way to the high end, the 27-inch iMac on the top end has a quad-core Intel Core i7 processor running at up to 3.5 gigahertz with NVIDIA GeForce GTX 780M series graphics and up to 4 gigabytes of video memory. All the flash storage options are now available in configurations up to 1 terabyte. So if you need a lot of storage, Apple can pack plenty into these new iMacs. The 21.5-inch models start at $1,299 US, and the 27-inch models are starting at $1,799 US. So you can go on Apple's website, check out the pricing, and configure up the iMac of your dreams. And those are shipping now. They're available in Apple retail stores. As a matter of fact, iFixit quickly got their hands on the new systems and then promptly did what they do. They ripped the guts out, looked at everything that was inside, and it turns out there were actually a couple of surprises in there. They noted that there's an undocumented secondary PCIe slot that could be suitable for an additional SSD or Fusion drive, so you could potentially attach some more storage in there. I don't know if anybody will, I would assume someone will come out with some aftermarket third-party ways to do that. They also noted that the SATA power and data cables have been joined for the hard drive cable, which is an interesting little update. And there is a slimmer heatsink on the CPU, and bad news for aftermarket upgraders. If you get a 21.5-inch iMac, apparently the CPU is now soldered on the motherboard on that model. Not so on the 27-inch model. That still is not soldered on the motherboard, so you could potentially upgrade those. I've never known anybody who has upgraded the processor in an iMac. I didn't even know that third parties made aftermarket updates for iMacs. Let me know if you are aware of someone who's doing that, but I didn't even know it was a possibility, so I don't know that it's that big a deal that it's soldered on there, but it was something that was noted in the iFixit teardown. And if you did get a new iMac, Apple actually issued a software update day one, or I think maybe the day after, for the new model iMacs. iMac late 2013 EFI update 2.1 is available. It addresses an issue where you could see a black screen when trying to install Windows 7 or Windows 8 using Bootcamp Assistant if both an external optical drive and USB thumb drive are connected to the unit. So that's a pretty specific little error, but you could run into that. Addresses that issue. It also ensures that the system will boot up into OS 10 after installing Windows 8. So it looks like the EFI update is mainly there to address some Windows and Bootcamp issues, but you'll probably want to run your software update and grab that if you picked up one of these new iMacs. And then also on the Mac update front, the Mac Pro should be here soon. Apple said it's going to be out in the fall. Many people are expecting it to be announced in terms of a ship date at Apple's October special event, which is just speculated to happen. We haven't had an announcement on that, but I would expect if it is going to happen, that invites should be going out soon and we should get a date. But regardless, another version of the Mac Pro seemed to have shown up on Geekbench this week. There were scores reportedly for a single processor 8-core version of the Mac Pro. You may remember back in June, it was reported that a 12-core model supposedly showed up and scored a whopping massive Geekbench score over 30,000 for the multi-core test. This time around, the 8-core version, apparently using an Intel Xeon E5 1680 V2 chip, scored a Geekbench score of 24,429 on the multi-core tests. So if that turns out to be an accurate model, I take these things with a grain of salt because they can be spoofed from what I understand. But assuming that is one of the new Mac Pro models, it's looking to be a screaming machine. It's going to be super expensive though too. So this is definitely targeted at the pro market. I've been telling people I would be shocked if we see prices starting less than about $3,499 US, maybe $2,999. It'll be interesting to see how Apple prices this thing out, but I think it's going to be targeted at the very, very high end of the market, and these things are going to be smoking fast from everything we've been seeing. So excited to see what Apple will have in store for us in October. Since we now know the details of Apple's A7 processor, it is now time, I guess, to start talking up and speculating on what the next generation of Apple's chips are going to look like. We saw a couple different related reports this week. Reportedly right now, Apple is opening up 6 more positions in their Florida GPU design office down in Orlando. I don't know if this has actually been confirmed. I remember the report that Apple was staffing up a GPU design center. We had rumors back in May that they were hiring supposedly 20 former AMD engineers and looking for more former employees to actually staff up a design group in Florida to put together and make designs for GPUs. It was in that report that they said they had set up temporary office space, but were looking to build a more permanent facility with a staff of up to 40 employees. This week, we had a new rumor saying they were looking and opening up 6 more positions for that office for various kinds of engineers, including one program manager who would handle the system on a chip embedded silicone designs for new GPUs. I have to say, Apple is becoming a pretty big chip design powerhouse. They're not building their own chips yet, but we've also heard rumors at some point that maybe they want to do that. So it makes sense that they want to bring more and more of the design processes in-house. And they've been packing in some awesome GPU technology into those A-series chips. So I see no reason not to believe this rumor, to think that Apple wants to put together just a killer GPU design team. As a matter of fact, the A7 is supposedly has the very latest Power VR technology in there, and the changes that Apple is preparing right now, it seems like they are really wanting to step up again for their A8 designs. And speaking of the A8 designs, there's been a lot of debate on who's going to actually be building those things. You know, leading up to the A7 launch, there were all these rumors and a lot of people putting on their money on the fact that Apple was moving A7 production, even possibly, to Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, TSMC. And that, of course, all changed when it was revealed last week by Chipworks that Samsung was still the big player producing Apple's A7 processors. Well, Apple had supposedly signed a deal with TSMC to provide A-series chip manufacturing beginning in 2014, but it's looking now like that might not be an exclusive deal. The Verge was reporting that TSMC will have a hand in making the A8 processors, but that Samsung is still likely going to get 30 to 40% of the chip production in 2014. So it seems like while Apple might want to move away from Samsung, it's becoming a slower process than some of us thought it might be. And TSMC is looking more like just a move away from relying on a single partner for all of the silicon on a chip production. Another possible explanation as to why Apple is having to hedge its bets on TSMC and turning back to Samsung is that the A8 is expected to be produced on a 20 nanometer process. And we know that TSMC has been working on that, but reportedly they've been experiencing difficulties most likely in terms of yield rates with that 20 nanometer process. And it was discovered, as I mentioned earlier, that the A7 is using Samsung's current 28 nanometer process. So they're certainly going to want to step up and go to an even smaller nanometer for the next generation chips. But it looking at like, at least according to the latest rumors, that Apple's going to have a couple different manufacturing partners. So I guess it's a good move away from dependence on Samsung as a sole supplier, but looking like TSMC is not quite there yet as Apple's new exclusive chip manufacturer. As I noted, this month should mark Apple's next big event, this one mainly focused around the iPad lineup. It's been expected for a while that Apple's going to update the Retina iPad as well as the iPad mini to their next generation versions. So that would be the Retina iPad 5th generation and the iPad mini 2nd generation. And most have felt that the big major update to the iPad mini would be the addition of a Retina display. That's been talked about since Apple put out the iPad mini. It's the next logical progression. And it's been this whole on again, off again, on again, and now I guess apparently maybe off again rumor that Apple will update the iPad mini with a Retina display. This time around, it's IHS iSupply claiming that their checks are showing that manufacturing volumes look to be pointing to a Retina iPad mini launch happening in 2014, not this year. That would be shocking to me, and I'm actually going to say poppycock or call poppycock on that, because in my opinion, Apple needs to, one, update the iPad mini this year, and two, if they do that update, it has to be a Retina display. I think they would just get executed in the press and the media if they did not put a Retina display on that, especially since we've seen so many other Retina resolution tablets from Apple's competitors in that 7-inch form factor, in that smaller size. So I think the worst thing that could happen would be that we would see Apple bring out a Retina iPad mini, but that there could be constrained holiday supplies, which actually could turn out for Apple to be a good thing. I think it's bad for us as consumers because we're going to have a hard time getting our hands on a Retina iPad mini, but it's good for Apple because it juices demand. It creates this frenzy for the latest and greatest iPad mini. And going into holiday quarter, that can be nothing but good. And it also would help spruce up 2014 first quarter sales. So I think what could likely happen is that even if manufacturing volumes are down, Apple goes ahead, they announce that Retina iPad mini, they put out as many into the marketplace as they can for the holiday quarter. And then once they get the manufacturing sorted out, they really ramp up beginning in 2014. And I think that's more likely what's happening. And even, you know, Tim Cook said, you cannot look at what's happening in the supply chain as any kind of indicator of what Apple is actually going to be doing. And I think they really proved that with the iPhone 5S and 5C launches. So I'm not too worried that we won't see a Retina iPad mini at this month's event, but it has been floating around in the rumor mill that we might not. But I think Apple can't not put out a Retina iPad mini. Some of the other latest rumors surrounding the iPads, of course, the styling on the fifth generation iPad is fully expected to be more in line with the iPad mini styling. That means reduced bezels on the left and right, slightly smaller size. We've seen some back shell case leaks and images out there comparing the different models. And those case leaks have also indicated that Apple will match the colors that we've seen on the iPhone 5S. So we're talking space gray, potentially gold, and the silver model. We've seen some gold leaked ones. With how popular the gold iPhone 5S has been, I hope Apple really prepares if they're going to release a gold model and makes that available in good numbers. Once again, though, for the iPad mini at least, I'm thinking supplies may be constrained. We've also been hearing rumors that Apple may integrate the Touch ID sensor across the entire iPad line to match up with the iPhone 5S. I think that's really cool technology. It's gotten rave reviews. I love the ability to unlock my iPhone 5S with the fingerprint. It works almost flawlessly. It's amazing, actually, how well it works. And it really beefs up security. So I think Apple would be very smart to continue using the Touch ID sensor across the board. But once again, that's another one of those parts that we've heard Apple has had supply yield problems with. And it could slow actual production and the available numbers for the marketplace for the holiday season. So again, if Apple does update the iPads and throws in that Touch ID sensor, I think that's another indicator that it's going to be hot this holiday season and hard to get your hands on one. So you're probably going to want to pre-order. You're going to want to get in line if you really want a new iPad come this fall. And then it's expected that Apple will also update the processor. We've been hearing rumors that it'll get the 64-bit update. Again, same update that we were seeing with the iPhone 5S. And in at least the full-size iPad, we will likely see them brand it as an A7X processor. That's typically what Apple does with the full-size iPad. It's a little bump up. And the X usually, in the past, I think, indicated kind of improved graphics performance to help drive that larger Retina-based display. And speaking of larger things, a very odd rumor, well, not so odd rumor out there, but we've been hearing more and more about a maxi iPad. And yes, let's never call it that again. How about if we go with the Ken Ray moniker for large size Apple iOS devices and just call it a Gigantipad? So Boy Genius Report has a piece claiming that a Chinese newspaper, the United Daily News, said that Apple was teaming up with their iPad partner, Quanta Computer, and that they've been working on designing a 12-inch iPad. The theory that was put forth in the report was that Apple plans to use the mega device to offset declining MacBook Air sales. And I thought when I read this, what? since when are MacBook Air sales declining? Last I heard, those things were selling gangbusters. But maybe they're planning for the future when MacBook Air sales start to decline, that they'll have a larger tablet-based offering for those kinds of consumers who want a bigger screen, but in a very portable form factor. Who knows? But, you know, as the piece points out, there's been the existence of this mythical whale iPad for a while. We've heard rumors and we've had reports surfaced from locations like the Wall Street Journal saying that Apple has been working on 13-inch iPads and 12-inch iPads. As a matter of fact, we heard those reports even earlier this year that Apple was testing 13-inch versions of the iPad, and I have no doubt that they're working with Quanta Computer to work on prototype models in all kinds of different sizes. I think we've even heard things as strange as maybe even 15 and 17-inch iPads. Apple really believes in the tablet form factor. Tim Cook has said we're in the post-PC era with iOS 7 and a lot of the changes there. We're seeing a lot more focus on getting software and applications to be more about content creation as opposed to just content consumption. So I think that's a natural progression, and it makes sense that Apple would be thinking about these things, working on prototypes, figuring out the different form factors. So I think it's actually pretty far from becoming reality. I don't expect that we'll see large 12-inch, 13-inch, and larger iPads and tablets happening this year, but they are expected to come at some point, and I think it's simply Apple planning for the future. So that rumor's out there. I wouldn't get too excited. Let's just get through getting updated iPad and iPad minis this year in the current sizes, and then see where that takes us. And then finally, in the news for this week, let's go across the pond over to Europe and talk about the EU Parliament Committee that has recently voted to propose a new law to standardize the power connectors on handsets, on smartphones and phones in that region. Apparently, there was a unanimous vote, and the idea is that they want to set a standard for all manufacturers to follow to reduce the amount of waste created by old and unused phone chargers. So they want to have a standardized version that would make it so that everybody could use the same charger and the same charging system. They haven't said exactly what the standard should be, but it's assumed at this point that they would opt for micro USB. And so they passed this vote, and I saw a bunch of stories saying, well, Apple's going to now have to put micro USB connectors in iPhone, you know, in the iPhone 5S and the 5C over in Europe. Well, we can't jump that far yet, because what you need to know is that while this was passed by a committee of parliament members, it's really far from becoming law. What they've done is just said, we're going to put forth a recommendation, we're going to start the process to try and move this forward, but it'll be a while before it's standardized, and there's no guarantee that this is actually going to become law. It actually is extending something that happened in 2009. 2009, Apple and nine other mobile phone manufacturers signed a voluntary agreement that they would standardize chargers for mobile phones using a micro USB connector. Now, the standard was set for the same reasons, you know, so that there was a standardized way to charge your devices, and the idea being that this would reduce some of the e-waste from different, you know, proprietary chargers being just thrown out when new devices are purchased. And so they set a standard, said, we'll make it so that we can charge at 5 volts, 500 milliamps, using a cable that terminates in a USB plug. But under that agreement, it did allow manufacturers to just provide an adapter to micro USB for their existing systems. So you did not have to actually have a micro USB connector on your device. And that's exactly what Apple did. Apple put out a 30-pin to micro USB option. They also now have a lightning to micro USB adapter that's sold at Apple stores for, I think, about £25 over in the UK. And that is how Apple complies with the current specification from the committee. And again, this was an opt-in thing. It was voluntary. This new action seems to be trying to move things forward to actually create a law that would require that you have to actually have a standardized connector on your device. So if this law does end up going forward and gets passed, then Apple supposedly or would apparently have to actually change the design of the iPhone to support this. But, you know, overall, in thinking about this, the logic seems completely flawed. And I'm even curious with the existing system if this really changed anything, because every time you get a new device, you get a new charger with your device, right? It comes in the box. So you have all these extra chargers. And if you have a standardized connector on all your devices, don't you only really need one charger? So what are you going to do with all those extra new chargers you get with all your devices? Aren't you just going to throw those away? Aren't they going to end up in the supply chain? I mean, I guess if you can use the wall outlet and it's a standardized cable, maybe there'd be less cables going into the landfills. I don't really know. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me, but I don't live over in Europe. What do you think about this? If you're over in that area, do you think this is a good idea? Do you think this is really going to help consumers if we standardize the chargers on our devices to something like micro USB? And doesn't it kind of stink that a government agency would kind of get to decide the standard? Gives a preference to a certain kind of connector, maybe not be the best technology. So you're not able to get the fastest, most innovative technology in your device because it's actually restricted by a law. I generally don't like the idea of that kind of control on, you know, governments taking that kind of control over a consumer-based company. But maybe that's just my opinion. But anyway, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Now I want to get to some of your feedback on the iPhone 5S and the iPhone 5C. We talked on the last episode about my experience going to my retail store and how they had a lot of the Space Gray model available and not very many of the silver or gold, but I didn't know if that was just indicative of my area or if that was across the board. We now know from some of the reports that came out after the fact that that was pretty much universal. But in getting feedback from you, it sounded like unless you went to an Apple retail store, there was no gold iPhones available anywhere outside of an Apple store and very few silver, which I found very, very interesting. I'm not sure why the silver and white model was also apparently constrained, but apparently that one was kind of hard to get a hold of as well. Something else that I got some feedback from on Desk gave me a point of order on my comments about the camera on the new iPhone 5S, specifically about the new f-stop. I had called it a smaller aperture. I had said that the camera on the new iPhone 5S had a smaller f2.2 aperture. What I really should have said was that it had a smaller f-stop of 2.2, which actually translates to a larger aperture. And Des pointed that out to me. And that's because a larger aperture is going to allow more light to come in. And that's what's going to give you that better low light performance that I was talking about in that episode. So I made a little bit of a mistake there and maybe confused a few of you. So I want to thank Des for pointing that out. And as a matter of fact, there's a trade-off when you go to that larger aperture, smaller f-stop, and that's that you get a reduced depth of field. And what that means is that anything that's not in that primary focal point when you're taking that shot with a smaller f-stop, that's going to have that kind of blurred effect. So that's when you see that camera effect where the thing you're shooting that's in focus, that's in front, is really sharp and crisp, but then the background is kind of soft and blurred out. And that's actually really a desirable effect for a lot of people. So the fact that with the new camera, Apple can give you better low light performance and this reduced depth of field is actually probably a good thing for most consumers. And that seems to be true because many of you wrote in to tell me how much you love the new camera and the burst feature and the slow motion feature and all of the updates that Apple did to the camera system. I told you it's probably my favorite feature. I'm enjoying Touch ID, but that's so subtle. It's just something that, you know, just kind of happens. You hardly even notice it on a day-to-day basis. But every time I pick up my new iPhone 5S and start snapping off some photos, I am just thoroughly impressed with how good, you know, how much better the images are. And they were great on the iPhone 5. It's just unbelievable how good a job Apple has done with this camera system. But I also asked you for just some feedback, some of your experiences on launch day with iOS 7 and with some of your new devices. And you sent in some great comments, including ones like this one from Ty.
Hey Adam, this is Ty from Utah. Just want to let you know about my experience with updating to iOS 7 as well as buying an iPhone 5S from AT&T. So probably as most people found that on the day of iOS 7 being released, it was probably not until about 1 or 2 in the afternoon before I actually got the download started. It kept failing and you know, probably was just overwhelmed by so many people wanting to download it. So, but actually, you know, from everyone else that I was talking to, they were having more troubles than I was. So I actually got mine done quicker than most people. Comparisons between the iPad 2 and the iPad 4, they feel like they're both just run so smooth with iOS 7. So I'm pretty excited about that. My iPhone 5 works great with it. As far as the overall feel of it, at first, my first impression of it was, I don't know if I really like this as much. And then features kept popping out to me. Oh, I like that. I like that. I like that. So it was like almost like an acquired taste. But overall, right now, my feeling is I've gone to iOS 7. I like it. There's nothing wrong with it, and I don't want to go back. So as far as living in iOS 7, I'm pretty dang happy. Then last night, So I get up at 12:45, and I had my computer preloaded to AT&T's premium website, and it's like saying, you know, it's counting down till time to buy an iPhone, and you know, I'm waiting. It's counting down, and at 1:01 Mountain Time, which is 12:01 Pacific Time, it says, okay, now the doors are opening, but just let you're in line, just wait until it's your turn. So I'm waiting. About a half an hour later, finally, it opens up. And then the dance, I had to type in my password. And I go in and I get to the phone that I want to update. And then it kicks me out and says I need to put in my password again. And I go back in. And I swear it was about 10 times before I actually finished the sale. My coworker that I bought the phone for wanted a gold 32 gig iPhone 5S. So it went through. I think the last thing I seen was it was 7 to 28 days before I'd get it. And then I got another confirmation saying I would get it in October, the first week of October. So it'll be interesting to see how well the iPhone does today, and iPhone 5S, and see how well it sells. But that's my experience, and now I'm gonna take a nap. So I'll talk to you later. Thanks. Bye.
Hey Ty, I hope you got some sleep. I'm sure you got some rest by now. But yeah, it was a long night for a lot of people. I'll have to say that online, a lot of people were saying that they had really good luck in getting in and out in no time by using Apple's App Store app. And in the past, I found that to be the best way if you're going to pre-order online, if you're going to use Apple's online system or anybody's online system, that's the best way to go. Although there were many reports of people having trouble with the carrier upgrade eligibility verification systems. So one of the steps that you have to go through when you're upgrading a device, if you're not buying a brand new device, is you have to get your phone checked and make sure that you're eligible for the upgrade pricing. And a lot of times that system flounders or goes down, and that can throw you off. And I know some people that were hit by that. As far as the ordering goes, I'll be curious to hear when you actually got your device, because a lot of people who pre-ordered, while they ordered, they were getting quoted delivery times of September 27th to October 2nd. Those people who got their orders in right away, and then it sort of fell back from there. But many people then found out that shipments were going out much sooner than that. As a matter of fact, I got reports from many of you who said you started getting your phones as early as the 24th of September. So a lot of people who were able to pre-order that very first, within those first few couple of hours, actually already got their phones by the next week and did not have to wait into October. So I think Apple's doing a pretty good job of trying to get these things out as quickly as possible. So I got that bit of feedback from Ty, and then I also received this voicemail from Gary.
Hey Adam, it's Gary. I wanted to give you some feedback about the new iPhone 5S. Definitely a step up from the iPhone 4S, which is my previous phone. I'm still having a little bit of separation anxiety from the old phone. I just, you know, kind of really liked the way it felt in my hand, being able to kind of navigate everything within a thumb's length, and I have fairly big hands, and I still find it difficult to get to those things at the top. And it is definitely, as I continue to use it, it's very, very fast and lightweight and streamlined, but there's a couple of things that kind of are really big call-outs for me on the 5S, like the touch sensor for your passcode is really, really handy. It's really nice. It's kind of difficult to not press Siri while you're trying to unlock it, but once you get the hang of it, it doesn't really happen that often that Siri turns on before you actually unlock it. I don't know if it's been a fluke or not, but at least two of the times that I've used it, it's kind of went to a position where it doesn't recognize my finger or my series of fingers that I've registered, and then I have to re-enter my password, which I've chosen to enter a unique long password, so I have to go and find it on another device, like with my one password, because I don't have access inside my phone to re-enter it before I can continue. So I'm hoping that doesn't keep happening. Otherwise, I'll have to either learn that more readily or, you know, kind of look at it a different way because it's not convenient anymore. Also, I don't know if this is probably something that we've known about for a while. I haven't heard it mentioned on any of the podcasts, but I use tethering a lot for my job, and I'm also on the phone a lot while I'm tethering. So I'm often balancing the data with my phone call, with the tethering, so I can answer questions while I'm on the phone, while I connect to the computers remotely. And I know that a portion of that bandwidth is for the phone call, and the other portion is for the connection, which doesn't really leave much for like remote connections to other computers or even doing that much on your phone, even with a really strong 4G connection. So I was really excited to get the LTE, which I thought, wow, I'll have plenty of bandwidth. Well, I must have missed the articles on how we don't yet have, at least in my area here in Wisconsin, in the Milwaukee market, the LTE or voice over LTE option. So as soon as you start making any phone calls, it drops you back into 4G. So once I'm on the call and I have it tethered, I get back to 4G. Well, I quickly found something I want to try and see if it will work, is that FaceTime audio, because it continues the call along the LTE network. And I know it's a data call at that point, but at least it allows me to use that data while on a simultaneous call and keep up that good bandwidth so I can do connective services while on the call. So those are just two of the things that I kind of saw right away with it. I did use the slow motion, which is extremely cool, and it seems like it does an excellent job of kind of steady camming it. I'm not sure how it works, but I try to hold my hand steady as it is, but even when you do that, when you're recording something, you can still see a lot of movement, and it looks like it does a great job doing that. And I tried right away the low light with the flash, and it seems amazing. I mean, perfect. You know, and I've always said, forget it, I'm not taking any pictures in low light or nighttime with the iPhone because it's just not worth it. They're junk pictures. And now it seems like it's a big option for me if you're going out to a party or you're just going to do things in the nighttime hours inside or outside, you can now use it. So those are a couple of big draws, and it's a great phone. So I think to finish it off, I did add the case for the iPhone 5 that Apple has, which is a nice case, leather, I think, or a like leather product, and it fits on it really well. And I've always gone with a case because I just don't trust myself not to have one. And I've always used the OtterBox cases because I love their products. But I did want to get something from Apple that I like, the original iPad 1 case that had that leatherish kind of plastic feel on it. Just easier to hold and grip. So I like that. And this new case for the iPhone 5S is really nice, and it's along those same lines. So I really like it. The only thing I've noticed is that the audio port, when you connect even the thinnest phono cables, other than the ear pods that you plug in, doesn't quite fit through that hole. So you have to use like a little bit of an adapter to get it down that small. But I do have a variety of small adapters already, and it's just not as small as it needs to be. So, all right. Well, I think I've added enough feedback. So thank you so much, and talk to you soon.
Hey, Gary, thanks for the great feedback. Lots of good stuff in there. A couple comments on some of the things that you talked about. On the Siri activating from the home button, a couple people emailed in and said they were having that same issue. And I think part of it is just maybe a little bit of confusion on how the Touch ID sensor works, because you actually have to just wake up your phone to begin with, but then to actually do the scanning, you don't need to press in the home button. So I think some people are pressing in the home button to wake the device and then also trying to use Touch ID at the same time. It works best if you just turn on your device, either press the sleep wake button real quickly once or just tap the home button, and then just simply rest your finger on the Touch ID sensor, and then that should unlock your device. Another cool tip that I wanted to share with everybody, because I was, you know, when you get a notification, you can, from the lock screen, slide, or you used to be able in iOS 6 to slide on that notification, right? And then your phone or your device would open right up to that notification. But if you have your lock on, then when you slide, it brings up the passcode ID. And you want to immediately enter in the passcode ID. But if you have Touch ID, what you can do is just from the passcode lock screen, when it shows you the numbers, press and hold, or just rest your thumb or your finger on the Touch ID sensor, and then that will unlock your device and then launch you right to the application that you got the notification from. So that's how you can jump right to your notifications from the lock screen if you're using the Touch ID sensor. Took me a little while to figure that one out. On the camera, taking better pictures with hand-holding your camera, I think part of the reason that works is that I had read or heard that there's new stuff in the software to actually take multiple shots, and then it'll try and figure out in software which is the best one, the one that is best in focus. So that might be why you're getting some better handheld shots, even if you're a little shaky when you're taking the shots. I've noticed the same sort of thing. So the entire camera system, I think the key here is that that's really been upgraded with a lot of the software. And then I totally agree with you with the Apple case. I got the Apple case as well, and I absolutely love it. But as is classic Apple, they always make the little holes too small. I got these, I mentioned on the show that I got these great lightning cables from Amazon, much cheaper than I can buy Apple cables for, and they still have a pretty small area around the lightning connector, but they will not fit with this case on. I have to use Apple's cables. And same thing with the headphones. Just like you said, it seems like only Apple's really thin 1/8-inch headphone jack will fit in there. Any other headphones will not fit without some sort of an adapter. Luckily, I have those adapters from way back when we had the original iPhone that had that sort of curved connector to it. So you had to actually have a really thin connector to go in because of how it was drilled out. And so I still have those adapters and I can use those. But something people should know about if they're opting for the Apple case is that you might have a little bit of trouble. And I already noted, I think, that it's hard to get it out of the case. So if you think you're just going to pop it out of the Apple case, I have a really hard time getting it out of the case. So that's a downside for that case. You might want to go with a different option if you need to connect to larger cables. And then the last thing I wanted to comment on is it's very interesting that you should mention the difficulties remembering the longer passcode. That was a tip I gave out in last show. I mentioned that now that I have Touch ID, I can go with a longer passcode because I'm not going to have to enter it that frequently. And I shared that with George Starcher when I was talking to him on that episode. And guess what? George ran into a little issue with that longer passcode as well.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Hey, Adam. Not too bad.
Yeah, welcome back. You guess you had an interesting week, which is why we're getting you back on the show. And triggered by something we were talking about on the last show, I had you on to talk about, you know, picking up your new iPhone 5S, and we talked about Touch ID. And I had thrown out, I think, during that episode that, you know, my plan, now that I had a Touch ID, was to switch from a simple passcode to, you know, a longer passcode. I forget what Apple calls it in the settings there, but basically you can turn off simple passcode and then put in, you know, more like a passphrase or, you know, a password, I think about as long as you want. I don't know what the limit on it is, but you thought that was a good idea until maybe last week.
So this was like this was partly your fault.
Yeah, partly my fault.
It's basically our angry love child of mistakes. So I listened to you and I turned that on, and I then made the mistake of not recording it in 1Password, even though I had based it on my existing passcode plus a little bit extra. I'm thinking, hey, there's no problem. I won't forget this. And
so you only committed it to your mind, to your memory,
yes,
and did not write it down.
Yes, I foolishly did not save it. So at least in 1Password. So what happened was, then of course I'm trucking all along all week, and there were a couple times where I had to put it in. I think I may have even rebooted once or twice, because when you reboot the phone, you have to put in the passcode before it will start accepting fingerprints again.
Yeah, I didn't know this until the 7.02 update, I think.
Yeah, which is exactly what happened to me, right? So I'm like, hey, look, there's 7.02 fixes the lock screen bypass thing, right? So I'll get to turn, you know, the thing back on in my lock screen, and I applied the update and it rebooted, and it was like someone kicked me in the head and I could not remember the password because it rebooted, and then I'm like locked out of my phone. And I'm like, oh, goody. Right. And
but it did it in an interesting way too. I mean, we were talking about this, right? It's not sort of how it handles things is a little bit unique in the scenario you're in.
Right. So what I found out was if you start to put in the passcode wrong too many times, it puts the phone into a disabled state where it will not let you try again. And the only thing you can do is make an emergency phone call. And that here's the interesting part. The timer increases every time you hit the disabled state. So it's like, you know, a minute, 5 minutes, 20 minutes, up to an hour. And once you reach the hour, and this timer never backs down. So it only goes up. So once you hit that hour point, every single failure results in you can't try again for an hour.
So it's a your typical brute force hack, slow down kind of technique, right? So,
oh, absolutely. And buddy, does it work.
how many, so does the number of times before it goes into that state that you can enter, you know, once it's reset? So the first time you do it, how many, do you know how many times it lets you enter the passcode roughly before?
I did not record that because I wasn't expecting it. And I did find a knowledge base article that talks about the disable and that the fact that there is an increasing timer, but they do not spell out
how many failed attempts you get before it kicks in the timer.
Yeah, before it goes to the next level of timer, right?
Right. And I'm assuming also, because there's that switch that we've had for years that says, like, after 10 failed attempts, you know, wipe the device. So I'm guessing you had that turned off, and I'm guessing that would accumulate. So if the trigger for it to go to disabled is 3 attempts or 5 attempts, you know, and then it locks you out for, what did you say the first time period was, a couple minutes or a minute?
It seemed like a few minutes.
So if I did 5 and then, you know, got to disabled and then a minute went by and did another 5 and had that feature on, I'm assuming.
No. It's not 5 between each. Once you reach that disabled state,
You type it
wrong, it's disabled, and the timer increases.
You only get one attempt. So if the first trigger is 5 and then the subsequent ones are 1, if I wanted to wait it out, I'm assuming once you hit the 10, if that other feature is turned on, then it would wipe your phone. I'm assuming that accumulates.
It's supposed to accumulate. It's supposed to reset. I could have sworn I had that on because I always turn that on, but it is possible that I somehow forgot to turn that back on when I didn't remember. I said I had to restore it from backup once I got it home to get my stuff on it. It's possible maybe I forgot to turn it back on at that point, but I could have sworn I had it on. But the point is once you hit that hour, it's like if you want to try 4 times because you, oh, I finally remember it, right? That's 4 hours to do all 4. And you end up going, how long is the restore?
Right. So you ultimately decided not to wait that long, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Well, what I did too is while I realized that when it says it's disabled, this is interesting too. Certain things still work in the background. You can't do anything except initiate an emergency call, but the phone is still at least on the cellular network. I don't know if it was on the Wi-Fi because it never showed me the Wi-Fi indicator, although it should have been. But it certainly was on the cellular because, and then I could, like, I sent myself a text message from my work phone and I hear the tone, but you don't see the display. But because I have a Pebble, the message actually came through the phone, even in disabled state, and went to my Pebble. So clearly there's still a lot of stuff functioning in the background. Calling the phone worked. I could answer it and it would still show me, hey, it's George with, you know, here's his picture from work, you know, in the contacts address book, you know, type of thing. Mm-hmm. So someone calling you still works even while it was in disabled. So that was interesting. And then of course, reading up on it and all that, I find out, of course, find your iPhone and all that still works while it says disabled. You just can't do anything. You can't trigger Siri. You can't, you know, tap the button on your headphones and make it start playing music. You pretty much.
Yeah. So it's unusable for the person who has it pretty much. But for you, I mean, the good news with all the stuff you're mentioning to me is those are all seem like things that you'd want to have for like recovery. So you know, if you left it somewhere and some good Samaritan found it, you could call it and they could pick it up and you'd say, oh yeah, that's my phone. Let me,
right. Or make, let me or make that it. Message pop up from Find My iPhone where it should displays a message. Please call me at this number, you know, whatever.
Right.
You know, you could do that. And so ultimately what I had, and also too, at one point during the day, because I you know, didn't really want to mess with trying to restore it. I was at work. I needed to do work things. I just plugged it into power and left it for a little bit. And I don't know if it did a backup while it was in a disabled state, but certainly maybe in between them, mm-hmm. a backup did occur because I had it plugged into power and I have iCloud backup set up.
Right.
So that when, because when I went later ultimately to restore it, the timestamp of that latest backup was, you know, like 12:48 in the afternoon, which is during the middle of this whole mess. Right. So I knew that, you know, I had, you know, had a good backup and all that. So ultimately what I had to do was log into, because I couldn't trigger it from the device. And even if I was close to the 10 attempts, I didn't want to wait, you know, a couple more hours to hit that 10.
Right. And plugging it into iTunes will do you no good because it has to be unlocked.
Oh, that's one other thing I forgot to mention when we were talking earlier. When you plug, because iOS 7 now, you plug it into a computer that's not the home iTunes machine where you synced, you know, synced up with it, mm-hmm. the phone will, or iPad 2 will now prompt you, hey, do you trust this device?
Right, yeah, that's
well, if feature. The phone's in the disabled state, well, guess what prompt you can't get to on the screen? You can't tell it you trust, you know, in this case, my personal laptop, I couldn't tell it to trust it, so I couldn't even get it to come up in
Yeah, even if you could, I think it won't let you restore a locked device anyway, so you'd just you'd be sunk anyway.
Yeah, so, but that was interesting, and I just thought, you know, that trust prompt you can't get to while this, you know, while you're fighting this battle anyway, sure. Right? So your only hope is basically that you're using Find My iPhone, iCloud backup, and that's what I did. I went into iCloud and just said, nuke it.
You got to get to wipe the device.
Yeah, let it wipe. And then I did, as soon as it came back up, I hit the activation lock prompt because it said, do you want to join a Wi-Fi network? Because it looked like a regular old setup step.
Right, it's, you know, when out of the box phone at that point. Mm-hmm.
internet through the Wi-Fi because I gave it my local Wi-Fi password and stuff. It then went, ooh, this phone's activation lock.
It's a registered device, yeah.
It's a registered device. So it did have to talk back to Apple to get that to come up. And then I put in my current, you know, name and password. And then it said, okay, now it'll go forward with the normal steps, which again, of course, it asked again for my iCloud when I said I want to restore from iCloud backup. So I had to enter it again. And then it started that process and it took a few minutes. And, you know, at some point it finally, the phone came up enough where it was now loading apps, which I had to give it that name and password because my iTunes store account is different from my iCloud account. And it needs the store authorization to re-download the apps, even though the backup of the data for the apps is coming from the iCloud backup. And it seemed to me that as the phone, because it took several hours to restore everything because I had a lot of junk on my phone and I wasn't on the fastest internet connection, but it was decent enough for the job. And at least I knew I would be in my phone before I went to, right? I didn't have to worry about wasting 4 hours guessing four more passwords. And then find out I was still wrong. So I found that when an app, like I wanted to sync my Fitbit and I wanted to log what I ate for dinner and my Lose It and all that, that it had the stuff current from that day. So it tells me that as it's restoring each app from the app store, it's also putting in its data, even though it wasn't done doing all the rest of the apps. So it seems to be an app by app progress.
Yeah, very similar to how Restore from iTunes goes, yeah. I think.
So I just, you know, I'd never really done many of those. So I wasn't 100% sure of did it get all the apps on there and then do the data or what. But it seems to be in tandem. So that was nice because I was able to do the few things I wanted. And I just left the bloody thing plugged in when I went to bed to finish.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's always been my impression, I think, that the app data is restored from the initial backup, the restoration. And I don't know if this is accurate or not, but it seems to me that stuff comes back from your backup files. And then it starts reloading all the apps. And if the data is there, I don't think it blows away the data when it reinstalls the app. I think it leaves it in place.
Either way, it worked out. So, you know, yeah. And I was able to get into app data once the app was restored, even though it was still restoring others. So that was good enough for what I needed.
Yeah, because it takes forever to reinstall the apps. Yeah. That's the worst part of the restore process, I think, for most of us. But what I love about this story and about what you're saying is this is exactly how the kind of security that I'd want to see in a scenario. You know, in this case, it was kind of inconvenient for you when you're the person with the phone and it's annoying, but it seems really good for the scenario where my phone's been lost or stolen and I want some opportunity to have some time to try and recover it, to try and use Find My iPhone and not have to wipe it immediately, you know, because I know I've got the passcode lock on there. I've got the Touch ID. This would really slow down any kind of criminal from trying to do anything with that device. And anytime they try and get it on a network, you know, you're going to have access to try and figure out where it is and possibly, hopefully, you know, going through authorities, recover it.
Yep, you
know,
absolutely.
And it gives you some time and then you can maybe wait, you know, a day or two. And if you can't recover it, then just go find, wipe it, yep. You know, because then you lose your ability to sort of track it. But, you know, it just seems like if I was a crook and I was listening to this, I'd just be like, I'm not stealing iPhones anymore. Forget it. This is not worth it. So worth it. Although I have said this too, I think they're mostly going to be just reliant on the naive public, you know, and sell them the phone and then they get home and run into all this, right? So maybe it's only going to be a deterrent for buyers, which ultimately I guess would be a deterrent for, you know, sellers, but who knows.
But yeah, if you are not at least using the free iCloud account for the Find My iPhone and to do the activation, you know, the benefit, the activation lock and benefit from the backup of the device, I would go do that now.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? There's really no reason not to.
Because that's ultimately what made it. Yeah, that's inconvenient to reload my phone. At least I'll get calls until I get home. But once I get home, I'm not going to really get any calls, so I can just let it restore. And rather than spend 4 hours trying to guess four more passwords to have it still not be the right one, and then I have to resort to it. You know? So.
And never forget your iCloud password. Just make sure.
Yeah. Set up all the security questions. Print them out. Put them in the safe. Whatever you got to do, right? So, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think we mentioned that we talked about this earlier, too. I guess you could always go reset your iCloud password on iCloud.com, go through the security questions and stuff like that.
Yeah, as long as you've done all that and kept a record of it, at least, right? So now I'm back in my device. All my stuff went back nicely. All my Bluetooth pairings were still there, all that good stuff. And I made sure that, because when it does the restore, the one thing it does not restore are fingerprints and passcode. So you're at least back into the device, and then I set those back up and I set it with a new passcode and I put that passcode straight into 1Password right then and there.
So now you're just moving forward. It's all okay.
Yeah. Now it's all okay. But I just thought it would be interesting for everyone to hear this.
Very good. Yeah. The real world testing of the system. I didn't think we'd find out this soon, but okay.
Yeah. But it was just really interesting about the way that whole disabled state works. Stuff still could come in. If you had a Pebble, I could still read the message, even though I couldn't on the phone. Right. The increasing timer was a bit of a rude shock. You know, I figure maybe the timer back down after a while. And then best I could tell, once it goes up, it never goes back down until you logged in once.
Again, from a security perspective, I think that's the good call on Apple's part.
Oh, absolutely. But it was just, it wasn't what I... You know, since I never had to do it, I didn't know what I was facing. And it's just sort of good to know. But again, too, even though the phones had disabled, I could still receive calls. So I'm like, I'll just keep it in my pocket until I get home. Then I'll deal with it.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good. Well, I appreciate you sharing your story. And sorry I had a hand in creating it, but that's okay.
That's all right. It was good learning experience.
All right. Thanks again, George. So there you go. A little cautionary tale. If you're going to be using Touch ID and that longer passcode, make sure that you have one that you can memorize. So learn from our mistakes, not your own, I guess is the takeaway from that one. And thanks to George for actually sharing his story with us. Last thing I have for you on some of your iPhone 5S feedback and iOS 7 feedback is Todd emailed me, and he wanted to know about the new AirDrop feature and specifically why AirDrop isn't supported on older devices like his iPhone, like his wife's iPhone 4S. And I also noticed when I upgraded to iOS 7 that I did not get AirDrop support on my third generation iPad. And I thought that was a bit odd as well, because it's a relatively new device. It's not that many generations old. And it turns out, I think only the iPod Touch fifth generation is supported. So what's going on here? I dug in and I did a little bit of research. I haven't fully confirmed this yet, but I read in a couple different places that it's likely because some of the technology behind AirDrop, it depends on something called Wi-Fi Direct. And it was something that was added into iOS 7, but it also needs to be built into the Wi-Fi chip and the technology that's in the device itself. And Apple's newer devices do have that technology built in, even though the technology, the Wi-Fi Direct technology, has been around since 2010. Apple didn't put it in the chips that they've been using in their devices until the iPhone 5, the iPad 4th generation, and the iPad mini have it in there, and the 5th generation iPod Touch models have that technology in there. So I guess you need that technology, Todd, to make the whole system work. It's my understanding the way AirDrop actually does work is that it initially uses Bluetooth 4.0, the low power Bluetooth technology, to create a handshake, and then it sets up a device to device Wi-Fi connection. And I guess it uses this Wi-Fi Direct technology to use that to make that happen. Now, why they can't use the standard ad hoc Wi-Fi technology, I don't know what's different about Wi-Fi Direct. If someone out there actually does know a little bit more about this technology and how it works and what makes it different, let us know. Shoot me an email. I'd be kind of curious. I might even do some research on my own to try and figure it out. But Todd, that seems like a logical explanation and might be why AirDrop is not supported on some of the older iOS devices. Something else that happened almost immediately after Apple released the iPhone 5S, and we talked about it last episode, is that we started getting reports about security issues with both iOS 7 and the Touch ID sensor, or stories alluding that there's security problems with Touch ID. And we kind of knew it was going to happen with the biometric stuff on Touch ID. There was a contest to figure out who could hack it the fastest, and then a group came out and said it was really easily hackable, and the media took off with all kinds of campaigns, you know, saying our security was being compromised by Touch ID, and it was all very extreme. And we talked about that a little bit on the last show, sort of how it worked and how it really had some pretty complex technology to actually make the hack work. And as a matter of fact, this past week, Touch ID, the hack was proven by a pretty respected security researcher to turn out to be actually pretty difficult to execute. You need some pretty specialized equipment. It's very time consuming. The main factor, and I think I mentioned this on the last show, is you're going to have to get a really good, clean, original, high resolution fingerprint to make it happen. So the odds are that you're going to be able to pick up just a fingerprint off of someone's glass or, you know, something that they've touched and not have that thing be smudged. To have it be good enough to actually fool the Touch ID sensor is your very first obstacle. And then there's a whole bunch of other ones past that. So it came out that that's probably not something that we have to worry about. The other thing that we heard about was all these stories about some of the lock screen bypasses. So there was a little trick to bypass the emergency call, and you could then place any phone call from a device if you got your hands on it. Or there was also a little bug that you could access the camera roll and some of the sharing features, the social media features, sharing photos to Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that, if you were able to get a hold of someone's device. And those were actually patched this week by Apple. Apple issued the iOS 7.0.2 update, and they patched those pretty quickly. Now, it turns out there's a new and even more difficult way to execute the phone call from the lock screen bypass, but I'm sure Apple will patch that in 7.0.3, which we're already hearing Apple is getting ready to release to the public. So Apple is pretty good about jumping on these security things and closing this up. But as I was sort of doing that stuff, I received an email from Rich who told me about something related to Siri that I think you really should be aware of. It's not necessarily a security issue. It's a little bit of a privacy issue, but it's something that's related to a feature that most of us want, we want to have turned on, and that's using Siri from the lock screen. But it was something that I was not aware of or hadn't really given much thought to, but we all probably should think about a little bit more. And that is, you know, Siri, I am a huge fan. I love Siri. I use it all the time. Being able to send text messages, to get directions, to do all these things while my phone is locked is very important to me. It's very valuable to me, something I want to use. But at the same time, when you have Siri available from the lock screen, it means that anybody that has access to your device can also use Siri. And Siri at the lock screen does give access to a lot of information that is in your locked device. Things like your home address. You can ask Siri, what is my home address? And she will show your contact record. You can say, what is my phone number? She'll show that contact record. What is my birth date? She'll read off your birth date. What is my spouse's name? If you have relationships set up in your contacts, she will expose and give that information out. Basically anything that is in your Me card inside contacts, and that includes all of your relationships, all that information. You can get access to your schedule and your reminders and all that stuff from the lock screen. That's stuff that you want access to, but it's also potentially stuff that someone who might get your device has access to, and then they could use that for other sorts of hacks and, you know, real world sort of hacking and trying to pretend to be you. Think of all the things that you use for security questions on other websites. A lot of times, what's your spouse's maiden name? Well, if you've put the maiden name into the contact record, someone could potentially find that out through Siri. Or, you know, I think of women who might be going out on a first date or a blind date or something like that. If the person got a hold of their device, they could figure out their home address, get their phone number, maybe information that they're not ready to share with that person yet, but it's right there and potentially accessible from Siri. So I'm not saying this to try and scare anybody. I just want to raise awareness that this stuff is available because I hadn't thought about it. And so once you know it's there, you can make an informed decision as to the level of security you want to enable on your personal device versus the convenience. So what I chose to do, because I don't want this information accessible from, say, my iPad or my iPhone, is I decided that I'm going to go ahead and disable Siri on the lock screen on my devices. And it's pretty easy to do. You just go into settings, you go into passcode lock, or in, if you have an iPhone 5S, it's now called passcode and fingerprint. And under that area, there's a section called Allow Access When Locked, and you can control access to different services from the lock screen, and one of those is Siri. So you can just turn that to off. And yes, it's less convenient because it now means I have to unlock my device before I can use Siri, but now that data, that personal information, is a little bit more secure. And it turns out, if you have an iPhone 5S, it's even better because you have the Touch ID sensor. If you set up Touch ID fingerprint, Siri works by pressing and holding the home button. Well, when you press and hold the home button, it also uses Touch ID at the same time to verify your identity and allows you to still use Siri while the device is locked. So you can press and hold, Siri will come up, you can ask her the information you want, and then once you're done with Siri and you go back or you put your device back to sleep, it's still in its locked mode. It doesn't fully unlock it. So it's even less of a convenience issue with turning Siri off on the lock screen if you're using Touch ID. So that was pretty cool. If you don't want to disable Siri from the lock screen, then something else you could potentially do, I thought of this idea, was to set up a limited contact card and then tell Siri to use that as your card. So the way you would do this is you'd open up your contacts, you'd create a new card, set it, you know, with maybe just your first name and your last name, just basic information that you want it to have, but none of that stuff that you want exposed from the lock screen. And then you could go into settings, general, inside Siri, tap on the My Info option, and then pick that new private card in your contacts thing with more limited information and select that as your card. Now, there's a couple huge downsides if you're going to do this. One is you're not going to be able to say things like, give me directions to home or call my wife, those sorts of things, because it's not going to know about those relationships. It's not going to know what your home address is. It's only going to have your first and last name. The other thing that is an issue is that when you change the setting, it sets that card, that private card with the limited data, as your quote unquote me card. So if you're sharing your contact information, like your V card, that gets changed across the board. And since it syncs through iCloud, that means it's changed on your Mac, it's changed on all of your devices. So that might not be a desirable outcome, but it would be one way to better protect your privacy in terms of Siri. What I'm really hoping by sort of talking about this and having this conversation is that Apple at some point will realize that we need the ability to define fields in our me card, in our contact information, that are private, that we don't want exposed to maybe certain applications. We don't want exposed maybe on the lock screen on a locked device. We don't want shared when we share out our contact information, say through AirDrop, which is something you can do now. You can AirDrop somebody your V card. Maybe you don't want all that data and information going to that person. You don't want your home address. You only want them to have your email and maybe your phone number. On the Mac, we've had the ability to set those fields as private, and I've actually covered that as a tip on a prior MacCast. It'd be great if Apple would finally extend that to iOS devices, and more importantly, then give us options and controls for how we want to share that information when we're actually using these different services and these different options. So I hope that happens, and I just wanted to point out some of the exposure that using Siri from the lock screen might open up to people and make you aware of that. Now, here's a fun little thing, depending on your perspective, I guess. If you like to get Rickrolled, apparently someone or several people on Apple's iOS team have been making a concerted effort to apparently bring the Rickroll back. For those of you who don't know what a Rickroll is, it's a reference to the Rick Astley song, Never Going to Give You Up. And it would be this trick where you would send someone a link or you'd post something and suddenly it would jump to this YouTube page and it would play the video for Never Going to Give You Up by Rick Astley. Well, TUAW had a couple of articles this week noting that Apple has made references to that song and to Rick Astley in a couple of different places within the iOS 7 support articles and also inside Siri. The first report came from an Apple Knowledge Base article where it was discussing some of the new features of Control Center and walking you through those. And the screenshot that's included with that article, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, has an image of the media player inside Control Center, and it's actually playing the track Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley. And then later in the week, I guess one of their readers wrote in to say that there's also a Rickroll inside Siri in iOS 7. If you bring up Siri and you ask Siri, what is today going to be like? Apparently, Siri returns the Wikipedia entry for Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley. And I actually verified this on my iPhone 5S. It worked. And so I'm curious now, are there other Rick Astley Easter eggs that we're missing here in iOS 7? Have you found any of them? I'd be really, really curious to know. And please don't send me a bunch of links to Rickroll me. I'm really curious to know if there's more of this stuff buried in iOS 7. But it's pretty cool to see Apple kind of bringing Easter eggs back into play, because I've had conversations with a couple people, Dave Hamilton from the Mac Observer and the Mac Geek most recently, about the fact that Apple seemed to be moving away from the Easter egg. We always had really great ones in the past, and I know there's stuff floating around there, but maybe more are making their way back into Apple products and into iOS. So there's one fun good thing that you might enjoy inside iOS 7, or I guess it depends on your perspective of the Rickroll, as I said, but a thing that you may have found a little bit annoying is that apparently iOS 7 came with its own blue screen of death, at least if you're an iWork user. This is according to a story I saw over on the Cult of Mac. Some iOS 7 users who are using iWork have been saying they're experiencing a crash and a blue screen on their iDevices. I was actually shocked to hear this, but was very easily able to reproduce the bug on my own device. All you have to do is open up iWork on a device running iOS 7, and that includes even running iOS 7.0.2. So you open up any one of the iWork applications, and then within the app, open up an existing document, something that you already have. So not a new document, but open up an existing document that you have. And then once that document has opened, just tap the home button. And what will happen is the iPhone instantly crashes, you get a blue screen, and then an automatic reboot. It didn't happen instantly for me. That was something that they referenced in the Cult of Mac article, but I was able to reproduce it after just trying this one or two times, and I did this on multiple devices. So it definitely is a bug, and I'm hoping it's something that they fix. The piece did point out that, I guess, resets of death, that's just where you open up an app and suddenly you get the Apple logo and the whole thing resets, or these blue screen of deaths where you actually see a blue screen on your iOS device before that happens, are nothing new. That we've seen these in a couple of different updates. And they also pointed out, you know, with any new major update like iOS 7, there's bound to be some of these bugs. So it's not shocking that this is there, but still, as being part of a group of people who have often made fun of Windows for its blue screen of death for years and years and years, it's not too fun as an owner of Apple products to kind of have egg thrown back on you, your face, and be now the recipients of the blue screen of death. And then finally today, I want to close out the show with a little tip on reclaiming some of the storage space on your iOS device. This actually came up, I got a couple of emails from people, got some tweets. Some people, when iOS 7, the update was released, they wanted to do the whole over-the-air thing, but soon discovered that they didn't have enough free space on their device to be able to actually download the update and then install it over the air. Now, a workaround for that is to just simply download it through iTunes and then install it from being directly connected. But if you want to try and figure out what's taking space up on your iOS device and maybe clear off some of that space, figure out what's eating up all your room, there's a great way to do that on the device itself. If you go into Settings and then tap on General and go under Usage, you'll see there's a storage section. It may take a minute or two to load, but once it's loaded up, it will show you all of your applications and then how much storage each application is using. You can actually tap on an application to drill in and see a bit more detail in terms of how much storage space it's taking up. And as a matter of fact, from the detail view for a lot of apps, you can tap and you can actually delete the application data right from there to free up some of your space. Now, be careful with this and keep in mind, if you do that, you could be deleting documents and data, any cached data that it may have pulled down so that you can work offline, those sorts of things, high scores from games, your game progress, all those sorts of things might get removed. So be careful deleting stuff from here, know what you're doing, or at least have some backups in case you need to get that data back. But you certainly can clear out space there. Another obvious way, if you have some apps in there that maybe you're not using anymore and they're using up a lot of space, you could just go in and simply remove or delete those applications. That should free up that space. But it is just a good way to know what's going on. In my case, you know, I had noticed on one of my devices that my photo and camera roll was eating up almost 2 gigabytes of space. And as a matter of fact, just the camera roll itself said it was using up 1.3 gigs of space. And I thought, well, that's fine. I'll just go into my camera roll and then delete all of the images in there because I back them up to iPhoto. You know, I actually connected to iPhoto and I've already pulled all those images off, so I don't need them in my camera roll. Well, the trouble was that when I did that, and went back in, the camera roll still said it was using up 1.3 gigs of space. So I don't know if that was a bug or what was going on there, but obviously it wasn't clearing out. Even though it was saying they were deleted and removed, I didn't see any images in my camera roll. There was still underlying data behind that. And for me, what it took to actually clear that space and get my storage back was to actually do a restore on my iOS device and then restore from backup. I was able to restore from backup and it still cleared out the space, but I had to go through that longer process to actually clear that. So I wanted to mention that in case any of you run into that problem. You normally should just be able to go in and clear the photos and information out of your camera roll, and that should free up the space for you to be able to use, but it didn't work in my case. And then another area where there can be a lot of data, and I actually received two emails this week from two different people who were shocked by how much storage was being used up by the Messages application. And this happens if you're the type of person who gets a lot of video or photos via iMessage or MMS on your device, and you save that stuff, you don't delete it, you save all of your history. Well, all that photo data, those files are stored inside the Messages application. So I had some people write up and say, I've got 3 gigs used up inside Messages. What's going on and how do I clear it? Well, one, you can back up that data to your Mac using a tool like PhoneView from Ecamm. I actually use that to pull off my messages and store them off my device so I can actually clear them off. You can put them onto your Mac and save the images. You can also, of course, go into your messages and just save any of your images or videos directly to your camera roll to actually get them out of messages. Now, that's going to move them over to the camera roll, but then you can connect your iPhone to your Mac and then sync them into iPhoto and then delete them out of the camera roll. But you want to get those things off if you want to be able to save them. Probably don't want to keep saving them inside the messages because it's just going to grow and grow and get larger and larger. And then once you've backed all that stuff off, you know you've saved it off to a safe location, you can go into the Messages application and actually delete that. There's two ways you can do it. You can either go inside Messages and then tap the edit button, click on the little circle delete icon and the little red one with the line through it and delete the entire thread. That's going to delete all of the messages from that person, including all of the photos and stuff that you received via MMS or iMessage. Or you can be a little bit more selective about it. You can select the message thread, go in where you see all the chat bubbles, and then tap on a bubble. And I'm talking about in iOS 7. It's a little bit different how you do it if you're running iOS 6, but I'm sure you can figure it out. I just don't remember the exact process. But tap on the little bubble and hold. Tap on hold on a bubble, and then a menu will come up. You'll have a more option. When you tap on more, you'll be able to select individual messages by just tapping on them. You'll get a little blue check mark in a circle off to the left of your selected messages. And then down at the bottom, you can hit the little delete or trash icon button to delete those specific messages. So if you don't want to clear the whole thread, maybe you just want to back up the photos and then just delete the photo messages out of there. You can do that way. And that will help clean up, remove and free up some of the space on your iOS device. And then I think the last and maybe most obvious one, I already mentioned it a little bit earlier, but go ahead and clean up any applications that you're not using anymore. A lot of us, if you're like me, you have app creep where you install app after app after app and you stop using them, but then you never remove them from your device. If you're not using the application, clear it off. Get rid of its data and information, and that'll help free up some storage space as well. Get a little bit better at managing your storage. But I thought I'd throw that out there because with the iOS 7 update, some people ran into that situation where they couldn't update because their device was full. And with that, I think that is going to do it for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch. Actually, they have a brand new application out called PDF Pen Scan Plus. It lets you scan documents from your iOS device, but more importantly, also does OCR, optical character recognition, on those. And it's just $4.99 right now in the App Store. So go out and check that out. Grab that one. SmileSoftware.com is the place where you can get information on all the great stuff that Smile makes. Also, Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets and get cash for that old iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products. It's cash that you can use to buy a new device. Maybe you want a new iPhone 5C or 5S. You should find out what your products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Transporter by Connected Data. Get all the benefits of cloud storage with the control and privacy of a physical hard drive or NAS. You can get 10% off your own personal cloud storage by using the offer code MACCAST. Just head over to filetransporter.com/MACCAST to take advantage of that offer today. And Squarespace. It's the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website online portfolio blog online store. You can get a free trial as well as 10% off your Squarespace account by going to squarespace.com and using the offer code MACCAST10. Big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. If you have a question, a comment, something you'd like to hear covered on the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is TheMacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online, I'm on Twitter, MacCast, or you can also check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And if you have a chance, head over and join the MacCast Google Plus community. Just search MacCast on Google Plus and you should find that. A lot of great conversations with the MacCast community are happening online on Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus, and I encourage you to join us there. But for now, that is going to do it. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.